Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast. Today I am joined by Dr. Thomas Egan. Dr. Egan is a medical doctor who graduated from the University of Massachusetts. He works as an emergency room physician, works as an individualized medicine physician for Gillette Health. He is a father of four and a dog wrangler. So, you know, the dogs, we'll start there because everybody loves dogs. I love dogs. Now, they're described as wolf dogs in your bio on our website. Now, is that a wolf hound or a wolf dog, or what is sort of the distinction there? They sound very cool.
They are very cool, James. And how are you today? And thanks for having me. So my dogs are called German Indian dogs. There is a breed of dog called American Indian dogs, and internet lore has it that they may have some wolf blood in them. They certainly look very wolfy. Having said that, they're very boisterous, very friendly, very rugged dogs. And a few years ago, my wife and I decided to leave an urban environment and move to the country. We bought essentially an abandoned dairy farm that is gone to woods, and we decided it was time to get a dog, and we settled on this breed because they are rugged, friendly, but they're also hypoallergenic, which matters to me because I'm allergic to most dogs.
Okay.
I can spend all day with the girls. And we were only going to get one, and my wife didn't want it to be lonely, so we ended up with sisters, and they're a handful, but they're fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I kind of have the, I guess, an opposite backstory where I grew up very rural and now have moved into a more urban environment, not necessarily downtown by any means. And when my wife and I were, you know, deciding on what sort of dog we were going to get, you know, you look at all the attributes, right? It's really cool to see, you know, how the behaviors and temperaments and what traits different dogs have. And I thought something, you know, practical, you know, it's nice to have a dog to look after the house. You know, somebody, you know, heaven forbid, tries to break in, have something practical, right? And then we compromised and got a Pomeranian because nice. Pomeranians are cute. So that's what we have for right now. And she's a good dog. So I guess with your background growing up in the city, let's kind of start there. And then, you know, what did you do growing up? What did you like? What did you not like? And then how you got into medicine. So anywhere you want to start.
Sure. So I grew up in an inner suburb of Boston, kind of an average suburban existence. It was my parents and my sister and I. I would not say that we were poor, but my parents were not well off. We never owned our own home. We lived in a series of rental houses, nice neighborhoods, but sort of never sort of had the freedom or feeling that it was our own. But on the whole, had an average upbringing, with one exception. And it's a significant exception because it certainly colored my life for much of my life. I have a mild case of cerebral palsy, which, you know, when you're a kid, anything that makes you stand out in less than a positive light is going to subject you to attention and sometimes even bullying. And when I was diagnosed in infancy, and my parents got for me the best medical care available, Boston Children's, Mass General, and one orthopedic physician in particular sat my parents down, and he was primarily talking to my mother because she was the force in the family. And he told my mom that you have basically two paths you can put Tom on. One is that you can treat him as a person who is not as capable as everyone else. He can get special attention in school, special bus rides, all kinds of services. Or you can throw him to the wolves and he will sink or swim. And mishmash of cliches there, but they're appropriate. And that's what my parents chose to do. So in some ways, I think my childhood could have been easier, but they made the right choice. So I grew up sort of trying to do a lot of things that I wasn't expected to do or that I was told that I could not do. And some things I failed to accomplish, but most of what I tried to do, I got it done. You know, I played high school football. But, yeah. And, you know, and I was possibly the worst football player in the history of American football, but I did it and I enjoyed it. And I started weight training early in adolescence for the obvious reasons a kid like me would, to be bigger, to be stronger, to not be bullied, to be more attractive to girls. You know, and consequently, I've been a gym rat my whole life. You know, that passion has never left me. You know, I'm in my 50s now, and I still work out 5 or 6 days a week. So
if we go back to adolescent Dr. Egan, what was your first one rep max bench press, like when you first walk into the gym? And that's the one that all the guys want to test, right? That's the first lift that I tested about the same time, adolescence, wanting to lift. Do you recall what that was?
Oh, gee, James, that was, I mean, I not only had CP, so I was asymmetrical, I was scrawny. So it had to have been under 100 pounds.
Yeah, well, I'll say my starting one rep max on bench press was 65 pounds. That was eighth grade.
Yeah, mine was probably in the same range. It's probably around that. But I stuck with it. And, you know, this is decades ago now, but it's, you know, protein shakes with bananas in them every day, just plowing in the calories and the
peanut butter for the calorie density. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And very early on, I had no idea what I was doing, like not dramatically overtraining as a teenager, but you know, I ended up even in my teens, you know, working out in gyms with people who were very knowledgeable and very advanced, and they kind of took me under their wings and corrected a lot of my mistakes. So I graduated from high school somewhere between 40 and 50 pounds heavier than when I started, and I thought I was a hard gainer. So who knows?
Yeah, those are solid gains for sure. And I think in retrospect, the latter. You know, your family, and as you said, your mother, the decision maker, choosing to put you on that path of like, hey, you're going to do everything that you normally would. We're not going to, you know, give you the easy way out, so to speak. I think that really serves people well in most cases, because in my mind, it would foster a sense of resilience. And you have two different kind of, if you go down that path, you have a kind of diverge where some people, when they encounter, you know, resistance, they become, you know, better from that. You know, they become more resilient. They learn coping skills and different things. And other people, they kind of fall into like an anxious or a depressed type state. Do you have any sense of what would have led you to be the former, where you became more resilient from that? as opposed to, I guess, being susceptible to those, you know, setbacks or resistance that we all run into when we're growing up?
You know, that's a hard question to answer, because I think on the level that you're asking about, I think it's intrinsic which way you're going to go. And I don't think you're going to know until mm-hmm. you're put under that kind of pressure. Although my mother has said many times over the years that I came out of the womb angry and aggressive and ready to fight the world, and she's, I never changed. Certainly I've mellowed a lot over the years. You know, when you're a kid and you're stuck in that situation, you have a lot of anger, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think early on, anger was a big motivator. You know, anger can motivate you to succeed if you have a chip on your shoulder. It can certainly backfire and make you bitter, mm-hmm. You know, and you evolve over time. You know, I'm not in my 50s the person I was at 19, you know, but I remember that chip on my shoulder from back then. And so I think that was a real driving factor for me. And then it sort of, it went quiescent for a while. But then when I was in medical school and I wanted to be an ER physician, I went to a very progressive medical school, but nevertheless, I got a lot of pushback from people within the medical school saying, well, Tom, you know, you need to set different goals because you're not going to be able to deal with the physicality of being an ER physician. And I refused to accept that. You know, I had prominent people within the medical school tell me, you know, you're a very bright guy. You should consider, you know, maybe being a neurologist. Mm-hmm. No knock on neurology. It's very interesting, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And I pushed forward. But I also don't want to suggest that, you know, I was a lone wolf, because there were a lot of people in medical school and residency who were really in my corner. You know, anesthesiologists taught me how to figure out how to intubate, because if you're going to be an ER doc, you have to be a skilled airway operator. And if mm-hmm. you have a partially paralyzed arm, that's going to be tough. I figured out how to do it, but I had help. Mm-hmm. I had people who were really invested in me. I had plastic surgery fellows go to the anatomy lab with me in the middle of the night to figure out how to get me to suture well. So yeah, I accomplished it, but I had a lot of good people helping me.
Yeah. And that's a pattern, you know, being surrounded by people that can, you know, build you up, and you can take the best pieces of those individual practices. And that's kind of a pattern I see in, you know, myself. I've had a lot of great, you know, teachers and physicians and so forth that I've worked with along the way. If we back up prior to you entering medical school and in residency, what was that actually, you know, prompted you to pursue a career in, you know, medicine versus something like, you know, engineering or, you know, another scientific field of sorts?
So when I graduated from high school, I was good at science, mm-hmm. but I wasn't interested in it so much when I graduated from high school. I was in college. I was actually a political economy major. So it was truly a classic liberal arts education, but my science experience in college per se was basically, you know, rocks for jocks, riverine biology. And I finished my undergraduate degree, and it's a while ago now, it might have been a year and a half later. I started graduate school in international relations at Johns Hopkins, and I moved to Italy to study in Italy for a year. And while I was there, my father got diagnosed with head and neck cancers, squamous cell carcinomas of the throat and the base of the tongue. And I left. I took a terminal 1-year degree and came home and to help take care of him. And we immediately went to Dana-Farber in Boston, you know, probably top 5 cancer institution in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they still operate this way today. When you go to Dana-Farber, they don't mess around. They get you in very quickly, and they want a family member besides the patient to be sort of their contact, because they think, you know, they feel like the patient's going to be very distracted and is going to need help making decisions and help managing the logistics of the biggest fight of their life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in my mid-20s, mid-20s, I became that person for my father's care. And it was then that I became interested in medicine. I don't know. I was like, wow. It was horrifying, but it was also fascinating at the same time. And my father's physicians and nurse practitioners and nurses and everyone who were world-class at what they do, they never talked down to me. They spoke in a sophisticated manner, but they seemed confident that I was listening to them talk to me, and I was like, wow, I get this. I get what they're telling me, you know, and I would do my own research. And it became this like, wow, I think I want to do what they do. And you know, kind of going back on everything else I had done, you know, I was like, well, and I had people tell me, you know what? You didn't take science in college. You're not cut out for that. You're afraid of the sight of blood, which I was my whole life. I'd get a blood draw and I'd faint. And I'm like, no. I can do this. And I tried to sort of test my interest. I went to EMT school. And meanwhile, you know, I wasn't going back to grad school, and I was just sort of, I was a college graduate doing odd jobs. I was working in gyms, running health clubs. I was bartending. Bartending, by the way, was my best training for emergency medicine ever. Teaches you to deal with people. Mm-hmm. So I took an EMT class, and when I was doing my hospital observation time, I did it at a really big, gritty urban hospital in Boston. And I looked around, and it was absolute chaos. I mean, I remember it to this day. And I looked around and I said, I love this, meaning ER medicine. I'm like, I want to do this. So I did a post-bac program at Tufts. I did all of the hard science prereqs in, I think it was about a year. It was very compressed. And then I applied to medical school and ended up at UMass. And I was, I think, the 4th oldest student in the class at that time. I started medical school at 32, which I think is really common now, but I don't think it was so common back then.
Yeah. And some of the, like, I guess, potential differences in maybe not the medical school then, the medical school now, but if we fast forward to your residency that you went through in emergency medicine versus what a emergency medicine residency might look like today. I mean, are we looking at, you know, you were doing 120 hours a week and now they're doing 60, something like that? Is that accurate? Because I've heard those things suggested. I just don't have the firsthand experience there.
So I would say that your numbers aren't accurate, but your theme is. We worked much longer hours than residents do today. And I'm sure but maybe there'll be some current residents who watch this podcast and take issue with that. But working conditions, I think, were rougher back then. But I'm not going to be one of those guys that says, you know, I crawled uphill both ways on broken glass, and it made me a better doctor than you are. I don't believe mm-hmm. that. I think quality of life is really important, but yeah, we definitely worked longer hours. Like when I was a surgical ICU resident, which is part of EM training, you know, you're going to do time in the SICU. We were on 48 hours straight where I trained. You know, you get 48 hours on in the SICU, and then you'd get 12 hours off or 24 hours off. Well, no, I think it was longer than that. But there were basically three teams, and you were on 48 hours in a row, which is not to say you never slept, but I definitely had points where, you know, I was awake for 2 days taking care of patients. And in retrospect, I think the changes that they've made in that regard are probably healthy. I'm conflicted about the idea of volume, though. If you work less, you see less, and you have less experience when you come out the other end. I think it's simple math.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most EM residencies now are still creating great docs. But I don't know if you know this, but the EM match last year was a disaster.
I did see some headlines about that. Yeah. Yeah. Didn't fill all of the residency slots that were available.
Not even close.
Yeah. The theme that I saw.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. When I was an emergency medicine resident, it was probably a top two or three sought after specialty. Because everyone thought it was cool and this seems really shallow, but everybody thought it was cool because of years of TV shows telling people how cool it is. And lifestyle is a big thing because, you know, you don't take call. It's shift work. You can work where you want, when you want. You can make decisions about how to work, when to work, where to work that support your lifestyle. And you do really cool things. And so there was intense interest in emergency medicine. And there were voices, people sounding warnings that, you know, if we keep this up in terms of like expanding residency programs,
mm-hmm.
we'll reach a saturation point and we're gonna have a problem. And I think one of the big problems is that a lot of the newer residencies have been opened by for-profit medical centers, and I question their motives. You know, the level of training that some of the newer residencies provide isn't as good as some of the more longstanding residencies. And I think it's no slight to the residents, but I think they're being shortchanged, and so are their patients. And so now there's an oversupply. And I also think that medical students who were used as forced labor in the war on COVID over the past 3 years are probably like, oh no, I don't really want to spend my time getting crushed in an ER where, mm-hmm. you know, we're never going to win. You know, it's an average ER in the US now. It's every shift is a battle, and you don't win. You know, you just do the best you can, you take good care of people, and you come back and you do it again. And I think a lot of younger medical school graduates, they don't want that. And I don't blame them.
Sure. Yeah. And there's a lot to unpack there. Really interesting to kind of see these patterns. And there's people, of course, like you said, that have seen it coming. And even the, you know, so-called, you know, not-for-profit health systems, I know that the, you know, CEOs of those companies make tens of millions of dollars. So somebody's sure always profiting there. But to your point, yeah, if you see like the latest, great, you know, the newest thing that's popped up that is a for-profit arm of a for-profit institution, then I think it is wise to kind of question those motives. And, you know, with the pandemic, you certainly saw people who like decided to retire early or, you know, transition into a, you know, different specialty, you know, nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians, respiratory therapists, all sorts of healthcare providers. So I think that did have kind of a sent waves throughout the medical community. And with the ERs now, I know that mental health, you know, just from my time working in the hospital and supervising hospitals, that the mental health burden on the emergency room is substantially more than I imagine it was 10 years ago, especially 20 years ago. You know, my father, who he was a correctional officer, and towards his retirement, he said it became more like, you know, hey, this is just a place they're putting people who are mentally ill and untreated versus a place for criminals to be. And, you know, yeah, I don't know the solution to it. I don't know if anybody does, but I would assume that's a pattern you've seen as well with, you know, people's first point of care is an emergency room a lot of times for mental health crises or, you know, not being able to get into a psychiatrist for 6 months, those sorts of things. I remember, you know, and this is when patients would roll up to the floor when I was working as an RN and say, okay, you know, get the information, put in the chart. Okay, who's your primary care doc? And they'd say, oh, you know, it's Dr. So-and-so. And it's like, wait, you know, that's one of our ER docs. That's not your primary care doctor. They're like, oh, well, that's who I see. So I'm sure you can relate to that 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, nowadays, there are days when 30 to 35% of the patients in my ER are mental health patients. And, you know, and people get frustrated. The mental health patients, they can take up a lot of resources. And I'm not saying that they're not deserving of the resources, but the resources are limited. Mm-hmm. So you have to understand that, and I know you do, that the ER is at times both the first resort and the last resort. You know, we in the ER is the only place in medicine that legally, essentially, can never say no. Okay. So if some other medical practitioner or a police officer or a paramedic or a social worker has a problem that they cannot solve, oftentimes that problem ends up in the ER. And we have to solve it. And sometimes it's not solved well. And sometimes it takes a very, very long time to solve it. In my own little ER, I currently, in my ER career, I'm currently working in a small critical access hospital in what is, for Massachusetts, a very rural area. And I spent the majority of my ER career working in big city urban medicine. Some of the challenges are the same. Some of the challenges are different. The mental health aspect, unchanged. Huge in urban and huge in rural as well. And in my own little ER, we had a mental health patient recently spend 6 weeks in the ER. It's disheartening. You know, it's not good for the patient. It's disheartening for the staff as well, because we're trying to take care of the guy, and there's other institutions that need to play a role in his care, and they're not getting the job done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think everyone in that situation, so, you know, yourself, your ER staff, the patient, they're all doing the best they can with the resources that are available. And that's what's important. And then obviously building towards something that's going to improve the, you know, how that situation is handled, the efficiency, the process in the future. one of the, what I think is, an underrated skill, patience goes without saying in the ER. But I think another underrated skill is the history taking. And this probably goes into infectious diseases, another specialty that I think really takes a good history, because these seemingly inconsequential details to the patient or the family can actually have a huge, tremendous impact on the, the way the care goes and the differential diagnoses that emerges. So are there any specific examples either from your practice or from, your residency, that attendings shared from their prior practice where this important detail led to this outcome?
Sure. One I can think of that is just a fabulous story, and I wish I could take credit for making the diagnosis. Wasn't me that made the diagnosis. Was actually a physician assistant that made the diagnosis. I was in working in a big urban hospital here in Massachusetts, and we had she was probably 65-year-old woman come in, and she came in obtunded, or in plain English, she had really altered mental status, essentially unresponsive, terrible vital signs, and could not figure out what was wrong with her. We knew that she had breast cancer and she was being treated for breast cancer, and she was dying. She was dying right in front of us. It was only going to be a matter of hours before she passed away. Got her admitted to the ICU. She was still in the ER. I intubated her, still was not oxygenating really well, really terrible ABGs, arterial blood gases, could not figure out why. And, had a sit down in the family room with her family saying, I really think your mom, I think your mom's going to pass away today. And I'm really not sure why, what's going on with her. So PA had a chance to spend some more time with the family, because your time is limited in the ER. As just an aside, one of the things I love so much about working with Gillette Health is the ability to actually take time and really talk to people and figure out what their needs are, what might be underlying, the medical basis for their concerns or their complaints. But back to the lady in question. So PA was the PA from the ICU. So she came down to the ER and she's talking with the family. And so what has she been doing lately? And, and she said, and one family member said, well, she's doing some homeopathic treatments for her cancer and it's working really well. And so the PA was like, what's that? So she was grinding up peach pits and making a medicine from peach pits. So, a lot of people watching this might not be old enough to have ever heard of Laetril. You remember Laetril?
Don't believe so.
All right. So show my age here. This was even before I went to medical school. So Laetril was a celebrated as a miracle cure for cancer, I think back in the 80s. But it was very quickly debunked in the US. So people would travel to Laetril clinics in Mexico. But if you handled Laetril wrong, you essentially got cyanide poisoning. Mm. So she was making homemade Laetril and she was dying of cyanide poisoning. But as we both know, that can be reversed and reversed quickly. She figured that out. And even though we were a large community hospital, we didn't have the antidote. And the PA reached out to all the surrounding EMS services. And for one reason or another, one of them had the antidote. And they delivered it to us. It was administered to her. And 6 hours later, she was awake and not dead, all because that PA got that particular piece of history. I mean, really profound example of that.
Yeah.
I wish it had been me, but it wasn't.
It's a super interesting case. And I think it goes to show with, you know, supplements in general, and, you know, those are growing more and more popular each year. There's like not a perfect, you know, Venn diagram between supplements and homeopathy isn't a perfect circle, but there is some overlap there, at least in the concepts.
Sure.
And you can have supplements that are causing side effects. It's not uncommon to see case reports, you know, like melatonin makes the headlines all the time for having, you know, 100 times or only 10% of the, you know, advertised dose there. Or seeing these, you know, synthetic, you know, supplement things that are causing acute liver injury. And that's, you know, going to be a diagnosis of exclusion. You see those headlines pop up every once in a while where, oh, we had this tainted supplement, or even vitamin D, you know, it was overdosed by like 200,000 times, more than just a rounding error. There was one case report, the gel caps contained over 200,000 IUs, something like that, that I think put on Instagram forever ago. So I think that's it.
SARMs in the fitness community.
Yeah. Yeah. And those things, they're still sold over the counter, I believe. Yep,
they sure are. So,
yeah. And unless you know where to look, so, you know, you've got a, let's say, a adolescent gym rat that comes in, you know, this generation's Dr. Egan's or James's, right. And they pick up their test boosters, which are SARMs at you know, GNC or any of these, you know, fitness and health and food stores. And then they are essentially, you know, shut down, you know, pituitary wise, you know, very low testosterone. And, you know, that can lead to some, you know, unwanted medical sequelae. You know, we know much more about hypothalamic amenorrhea in women, but you're basically inducing a similar state in adolescent men, adolescent boys. You're going to see some of the same consequences with the bone loss that are going to happen downstream. And I think some of these kids are probably getting put on, you know, needless treatment. And some of these children are being told, hey, you know, there's nothing wrong. Like, you know, this will, you know, fix itself. And people just don't have the education, and there's not really a good point of contact. Even if this, you know, kid gets set up with an endocrinology referral, I don't know that your average endocrinologist is aware of like SARMs and how to manage those sequelae. How to get things up and running again, just because I don't think it's published as much in the journals. And that's really the point of contact for those specialists, for any, you know, specialty, is, you know, having those articles and being able to, you know, disseminate that into your practice. So I think that's another case where, you know, we'll probably see like 5-10 years from now, you know, more and more things being published about that, and like, oh, it would have been nice to have this, you know, 10 years ago sort of thing, you know, hindsight being 2020.
Yeah, I agree.
So you mentioned being able to take the time with the patient, and actually, you know, that's a great example of the case you just gave there with the homeopathy. And then in Gillette Health doing that versus the, I saw a headline, it was something like the average, you know, doctor's visit now, so traditional medical setting, is something like 7 minutes. And of course, you have maybe a nurse doing a med rec there, and then 7 minutes with the physician, I think, is what they were slotting as that 7 minutes. But it would seem to me it'd be awfully hard to get to the root cause of anything in, you know, 7 minutes. And then you can have, you know, sloppy med recs or things like that that just get missed and cause, you know, medical harm down the line.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I am still an ER physician. Obviously, I'm doing more and more work with Gillette Health, and I'm very happy about that, and plan to continue in that direction and sort of dial down the ER. I don't know that I will ever leave it entirely. Mm-hmm. I'll still work, you know, 1 or 2 days a month, because it's sort of what I've always done and what I know, but they're very, very different areas of medicine. You know, you say that average is 7 minutes. I tell people in the ER, you know, or when people, I don't tell the patients, but like people ask me, you know, what's the ER structured like? Like, how do you run your life in the ER? And it's basically, well, I have about 10 minutes to figure you out. So whether you're having a huge heart attack, a brain bleed, you have an abscess on your butt, or a broken ankle, I got about 10 minutes to figure you out. And, you know, the medical establishment probably wouldn't want me to tell the world this, but there's a lot of guesswork in emergency medicine. It's educated guesswork, but it's high stakes guesswork. You know, other specialties have traditionally called ER docs cowboys. We're not cowboys. We have to make decisions very quickly with incomplete information. Now, a neurologist can take multiple visits, send you for all kinds of outpatient testing to diagnose you with that ultra rare genetic condition that may or may not be amenable to treatment. So, you know, and this would be a really classic one, you know, is my patient having a big inferior MI, or is my patient having an aortic dissection going back into the root? The symptoms can be exactly the same. And an EKG with an aortic root dissection is going to be, can look very similar to an inferior MI. And they're treated very differently. But either one, you got to treat it really quickly. So you better figure out which one it is. And, you know, I think I'm still good at it. But I've been doing it for a long time, and finding my way to Gillette Health, you know, for me personally, what it's done is reinvigorated me, or re-energized me as a physician, because it is a subspecialty that is near and dear to my heart, obviously. I found my way to Gillette Health because I was trying initially to fix my own problems, and I wasn't satisfied with the care I was getting to fix my own problems. And I said, you know what? This is me again. I can do this. I can do this better. And I started to do my own research into why are people taking this approach with me, and why isn't it working? And, you know, what should I be doing, and who's going to help me with this? And that led me into the field. And then I eventually found my way to Kyle and you. And it was one of the best things that's happened to me in recent years, because it's sort of regenerated my enthusiasm for medicine. I'm still a very good ER doc. Please don't get me wrong. And I don't mean to be arrogant, but I'm good at it. But working with Gillette Health, I'm surrounded by people who are really passionate about what they do. They're enthused about it. You guys are bright to the point of being brilliant. And it's challenging. It's challenging in a good way. I need to think. I need to be an active learner. I always, and not just rely on in the emergency department. Honestly, yes, I'm always learning, but most of it I've been doing for almost two decades, and I know what's coming, and I know how to fix it, and I like the patients as well, because the emergency department can be a dark place. You see people at their worst. You see people at their medical worst, their emotional worst. And you also see people that, I'm not blaming them, but they didn't do a whole lot to avoid what eventually befell them. And our patients at Gillette Health, they're very bright as a group. They're motivated. They want to stay healthy. They want to be energetic. They want to make gains in life, even at my age. And I get to help them do that. And it's just, it's fabulous. So,
yeah. And I love that process when you know, mesh up with a patient, you're building out your blueprint or your roadmap to, you know, improving their health and preventing all these sequelae so that they don't end up, because, you know, you could see it coming from, you know, a decade, two decades away. It's like, oh yeah, you know, I've seen how this one ends, you know, already. Yep. And helping people to prevent that and extending the number of years people have high quality of life and the health span. It's a theme that's coming out more and more now. I think more people are looking for something like that because, you know, like yourself, they have been frustrated in some aspect with the traditional medical system. So as far as, you know, your personal journey and stepping outside of traditional medicine into something that's more outside the box, is that something that you want to get into and talk about?
Sure, if you'd like.
For sure. Yeah.
I mean, actually, the story's fairly simple. You know, like I said earlier, I've always been a gym rat. I've always wanted to stay fit and strong and attractive. And earlier in my life, I mean, I guess you could call that shallow. You know, sort of, you know, that was how I viewed fitness, you know, from my teens into my 20s, even into my early 30s. Started to change when I went to medical school and I started to understand about disease processes and where things can end up if you aren't paying attention, you know, like, you know, and understanding why did my father get cancer? Why did my father have a stroke at 43 and my cousin have a stroke at 50 and my other cousin have a quintuple bypass at 53? And so then, so the sort of the vanity part of it, so to speak, never went away. Like, I still want to know that I can bench press a lot. And maybe that's silly at my age, but, you know, I never outgrew it. But then the health aspect came into it, you know, in my 30s, in my 40s, and now I'm in my 50s, and it's really important because, you know, I'm not done yet. You know, I've got a lot to do, and I want to function at a high level for a long time. And I have conversations with our patients, and they all feel the same way, you know, and so I get to help them do that. But so my journey, once I hit probably my late 40s, maybe I was doing well into my late 40s. And then I started to be like, why am I not strong? Like, you know, why am I so tired? Like, I'm trying to do the right thing and it's not working. It's not working the way it used to. And got to a point where I felt pretty awful. And I went to my primary care, who I've known for decades. He is still my primary care. He's a great guy. He's associated with a tertiary care center. So he's current. You know what I mean? He's not some guy that stopped learning 30 years ago. He's current. Mm-hmm. And he knows that I'm affiliated with Gillette Health. He knows that I'm also a Gillette Health patient, and he's fascinated by what we do. He doesn't do it himself, but he's fascinated by what we do and he's supportive of it. And, you know, and I'm going off on a tangent here. You know, some of our patients aren't that lucky. You know, their primary care doctors or their cardiologists are much more skeptical of our philosophies. And, you know, it's almost like they don't seem to understand that everything we do is science-based, probably to a degree that exceeds what they're doing. You know, just the constant focus on learning within Gillette Health Mm-hmm. It helps us to take really good care of people. But I got to this point where I felt awful. And I went to see my primary care doctor and I said, I feel terrible. Can you check my testosterone? And this is a classic story. You know, we've both heard this story dozens of times, if not more. So he says, sure, I'll check your testosterone. Checks my testosterone, checks, you know, did basic labs plus a total testosterone, nothing more. And I remember the exact number. It was 218. I'm like, can I go on testosterone? And he says, well, Tom, technically your number's within normal range, especially for age. At least at that institution, the normal range was 200 to 850. So I was at the extreme low end of the normal range. And he said, you know, you're within normal range. And, Tom, you're busy. You know, you got married, you had one set of kids, then you did it again. So, you know, in my personal life, my wife was married before. So I have two sets of kids. My older kids are in their 20s, but they came to live with me when they were 6 and 8. And then we did it again. So we have 4 total. We call them the big kids and the little kids. Anyway, my doctor says, you know, you got kids and you're old and you're an ER doc and, you know, you have a really high stress life. And maybe you're depressed. And I'm like, I'm not depressed. I feel awful. You know, and he's like, oh, maybe we could try, you know, some like androgel type stuff. And I was like, no, I don't think that's going to work. And so, no disrespect to my doc. And again, he's still my primary care doc and I love him. He's a great doctor. I went out and went to a TRT clinic and got on TRT. And I definitely felt a whole lot better. And I am on TRT to this day and it works for me. And I don't foresee any circumstances where I will change that. But I started to question the way they were doing it. Like, I thought the approach was kind of cookie cutter. And like I was on anastrozole and it's like, well, why am I on anastrozole? You know, and I started to delve into it and I thought, well, you know, I can do this. I can do this myself. Just the whole theme of this conversation. I can play football. I can do this that I'm not supposed to. Well, I can do this. But I wasn't cavalier about it. I really started to do a lot of research and then did get a position in the field. And then now I work with the best company in the field. And, you know, and it's kind of a, I think it's a good opportunity for me to emphasize something that I know you will agree with. And I know Kyle agrees with as well. We are not a TRT clinic. We are so much more than that, like so much deeper than that in terms of what we try to help people with. And obviously we have people on TRT, but TRT is not a one-stop, one-item solution for everybody's problem. It's not even the answer to low testosterone for a lot of people, you know? And I think that's a huge difference between Gillette Health and a lot of other clinics. You know, we are not a TRT clinic. TRT is a part of what we do for some patients, but I think we're so much more than that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think that if you're looking at any clinic that is, you know, outside of the traditional medical model, you have to look at how like diverse is the, you know, the suite of services they offer. So if it is just a singular, you know, TRT is the only thing that they offer, then, you know, are they going to be managing the sequelae of that? Because, you know, you can, and people do have side effects from testosterone. Mm-hmm. It's not a miracle for everybody. You know, the minority of our patients, you know, it's definitely the minority that are on any kind of testosterone. But yeah, some guys are going to go on testosterone and they feel great, right? They get their vitality back. Other guys are going to go on a testosterone and they stop sleeping or get migraines. Those things can absolutely happen. So mm-hmm. when, you know, someone goes out and is talking about it's all upside, there's no downside, I always want to be a little bit skeptical of those things. And if I go back to my, I guess, earlier childhood, so adolescent James in high school, a teacher did tell me, and this was in a very small town, I think the high school is rated like 2 out of 10, if you're looking on like Zillow in the neighborhoods. But a teacher did tell me,
you overcame.
Did tell me that, you know, whenever you hear something, he's like, you don't want to just believe it right away. He's like, you always want to question things and ask yourself why. So that was a useful piece of advice. And I believe it was the same teacher that also said, if you ever find yourself at an ATM at 3 in the morning, you probably don't need whatever you think you need that money for. I haven't had to use that second piece of advice.
I like that.
That was another piece of advice I think the same teacher gave. But yeah, I think to even go back to yourself mentioning, you know, you didn't jump ship and abandon, you know, your primary care provider. And that's something that's very important that we emphasize with our patients as well. If somebody's listening to this right now and you don't have a primary care provider, you know, go establish it wherever someone is local to you, like whenever you can be seen. Get in and get established. It doesn't mean you have to see that same person the rest of your life, but you would rather have them there and not need them than not have them there. And then now you need a referral to neurosurgery and it's going to be a complicated process. You just want to have that person in your health team, even if you are seeing a, you know, clinic that is sort of optimizing or looking at things from a preventive standpoint.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more, 100%. And I'll pivot back to your story from when you're up on the floor and your patient says, you know, my primary care doctor is Dr. Jones. And you're like, well, he's an ER doc. I meet so many people with no or with ineffective primary care. And you don't want to see me as an ER doc. You want to see me at Gillette Health. but you don't want to have to come see me as an ER doc. And you know, the acute, crazy, awful manifestations of chronic disease processes that are not attended to in the community. It's just mind-boggling. Like, it's bad for patients and it's bad for the country. It's expensive, you know? So yeah, definitely come see us. We, you know, I'm absolutely confident we will optimize you successfully, but yeah, you definitely should have a primary care doctor.
Yeah, totally agree. And even just the amount of, you know, health information that is out there. And in one of our recent podcasts, we talked about some, you know, red flags to look like. If you have people that are making claims with no citations, you know, that's something that people should be a little bit wary of. You know, you can't believe everything you see on social media or, you know, TikTok. You have people giving health advice that have no business doing so. And you have some other people that are giving it really exemplary health advice that is beneficial, that's probably more effective than any public health initiative has been, you know, up to this point.
Yep.
But you have to know who, you know, to listen to, because you do come up with a lot of things that are contrary to the, you know, all the evidence. And there's so much literature out there now. It's difficult for the average person to, you know, sit there and Google something and figure out like what's what, because you can find a study to support just about everything if you go back to rats. Or if you go back to a petri dish study, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So as far as fitness now, what does a typical week of fitness and training look like for Dr. Egan?
So I am at heart a weightlifter. Bodybuilding style, powerlifting style. Certainly with my cerebral palsy, there was no way I was ever going to be an Olympic lifter, because I just can't move weight, you know, that quickly with that level of coordination. You know, it certainly has evolved over time, but now, so I would take, let's say I take a 7-day period. I, some years ago, sucked it up and realized that cardio is important. So I do not like cardio at all. I'd rather be lifting weights, but I do both. I really do. I'm committed to doing both. And, you know, I'm busy, and but the problem is everybody in the U.S., everybody in the 21st century is so busy. So I set my life up like I'm going to work out every day, but I don't. So if I can succeed in working out 5 out of 7 days, I do well. And so when I say that, like, let's say, you know, I have to go to the ER tomorrow and we work 12s. And so I'm going to get up in the morning and I'm going to ride the bike for 60 minutes. And I wake up and I just can't do it. So that happens 2 days a week. So I probably average 5 days a week. Currently, I'm really sort of alternating workouts between weight training and, so I'll do a weight training workout, then a cardio workout, then a weight training workout, then a cardio workout, which is, that's fairly recent for me, because I decided in, you know, during COVID, like, get a little fat here. My wife and I, you know, we're lucky that we, you know, have the ability to do this. We built a gym in the basement. I know you have a gym at home too. So, you know, we've been training here, and, you know, we have enough equipment that we can work out aggressively. So I'm doing more cardio than I used to, and it's good. I feel better with the cardio. And, you know, and I got to go get my DEXA scan. But I feel like my body composition is changing in the right direction. And yeah, so my weight training is, I would say, from, it's sort of a bodybuilding style. Like I'll do set rep ranges like 15 down to 6. I don't max very much.
So are you a full body 3 times a week kind of guy, or a push pull legs kind of guy?
So I have been generally over time push pulls, and haven't done a lot of direct leg training in the last few years, because when I decided I had to fit the time in for cardio, I was like, well, what am I going to sacrifice on the altar of cardio? For me, it was legs. And, you know, everybody has their own sort of genetic predispositions. I can sort of get away with that because legs is the thing on me that grows the easiest. So, you know, when I was playing high school football, like, you know, like I think I was a sophomore, I think I weighed 135 pounds and it was all thighs though. I weighed 135 pounds and I was doing like 600 pound leg presses, you know? And so my wife and I recently got a commercial grade convertible leg extension, leg curl machine. And I, so I added back in leg extensions, leg curls. I mean, we have the capability to squat here. I hate to admit this, but I think I'm probably getting too old to squat really heavy. And if I can't squat heavy, I don't want to squat. So currently I'm doing basically push pulls with a smattering of legs put into the push pulls with cardio on the opposite days.
There you go. Yeah. And I think it doesn't have to be incredibly complicated, something that people will, you know, overthink. You know, they want to have a 100% optimized training program before they even get started. You get, you know, paralysis by analysis, right? Before you even get into it. And that's what I've got a stationary bike. I picked up mine used off of Facebook Marketplace. You can get really good value. There's even services that'll deliver that. So the barrier to somebody getting in cardio now, unless they have some sort of, you know, functional limitation, then it's really low. And the same could be said for, you know, even body weight exercises. Someone could get started there. Like you, I have about a half of a home gym at this point, but I do have the equipment to, you know, barbell squat here, but I don't do it because my squat rack was a sub $200 Black Friday special, and I don't trust it. I think I
sent you pictures
of those welds, right? I think I sent those a while back.
Yeah, I remember those.
So yeah, I'm trying to keep myself out of the ER.
And I enjoy training my wife. Like, I'm not a certified personal trainer, but I've been in gyms so long that I sort of like the basic knowledge of how to do it and how to adapt. I have, you know, so it's sort of like if I need to lose 10 pounds, I can lose 10 pounds. Or if I want to increase my squat max X number of pounds in 6 weeks, I know how to do it because I've done it before. On an informal basis, I enjoy like showing other people how to do that, you know, like nurses at work. And you're absolutely right. Like either one of us, I bet, can figure out a body weight workout that if people commit to it, they can make significant changes, you know? So that's fun. You know, I consider fitness and coaching my wife actually to be a hobby, you know, and I'm lucky that I married someone who is committed to fitness as well. I mean, you know, if one person is really committed to fitness and health, like say one person wants to spend a lot of time and effort with us at Gillette Health, really optimizing everything they can. And I'm not saying I know people like this, it's just hypothetical. And their partner isn't interested. I've literally seen that cause stress in relationships. You know, so I'm lucky that my wife and I share that passion. So I ended up, for a lot of reasons, I married the right lady.
Yeah, for sure. Having the right person and similar goals and, you know, health as a family. You know, we love to take care of families, couples, you know, husband and wife, you know, here at Gillette Health, because it's so much easier if you have someone else who's on board with it. And, you know, that way you don't lose your temper when you're trying to, you know, get your body composition optimized and they walk in the house with hostess cakes. That can cause some stress in the relationship. I think I've used that example before. But yeah, there's just so many ways to mix and match it. In our body composition podcast just came out and we went over one of the training splits in there. And I'm probably not going to remember all six exercises, but I'll give it my best here.
Oh, wait. I apologize. Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
Is that the one where they were like focused on calves?
Yes.
I watched it. I watched it while I was on the exercise bike.
There you go.
Get yourself a podcast. And what were these people thinking?
Yeah. So these were trained individuals. So these were gym bros, right? They go, they work out at the gym. Presumably they had some kind of a split that they were set up on. I think an interesting metric to add to that study would have been like, you know, rate your current fitness, like your current exercise regimen on a scale of 1 to 10, how effective do you think it is? And then they switched them to, they were trying to compare like interval style, CrossFit yeah. style versus traditional strength training. And there was bench press in there. There was a, I think a lat pull down, the ankle extension, which was the calf raises.
An elbow flexion.
Yeah, it's a bicep curl of some sort, yeah. elbow flexion. And yeah, I'm forgetting what else there may have been squat in there. I think there was squat in there at least. So those are the, you know, the big ones, right? And the individuals in that study on average put on muscle and lost body fat doing just those six exercises, which I just find, you know, they're doing like basically whole body 3 times a week. But whatever they were doing previously was worse than that, presumably. So a lot of people, you know, they work out and, you know, it's a good place to start, but you do have to, you know, do whole body. So maybe they were just not training legs and that's where all the gains came from. You know, a lot of people are doing curls in the squat rack still, right?
Yep.
Yep. And like you, I think legs are my best body part, not because they grow particularly quickly, but because they're very short. So they appear wider.
Yeah. You've told me that before.
Yeah. But no, this has been fun. You know, sitting down, I learned some things about you that I didn't know previously. I think people really enjoy listening to this and getting to know Dr. Egan, which I remember this story. The first time that you and I met, you said, call me Tom. And I think it took me about 5 or 10 more times of saying Dr. Egan and you saying, call me Tom,
yep.
Before I adopt that. But, you know, I still do hold the MD and the DO in a certain reverence, the physician title. Now, but yeah. Well,
yeah. I mean, this has been fun, James, you know, and I told you before when we were setting this up that, you know, I was a little anxious about it because even though I'm talking to people all day in the ER, you know, I'm like the idea of being on the internet was a little bit intimidating, but no, really, this was fun. I enjoyed it. And I hope we can do it again. As some sort of very topic specific, maybe discussion we can do again. And, yeah, thanks. It was fun.
Yeah, for sure. No, thank you for taking the time. And we'll definitely have to have you come back on again and we'll figure out what we dive into next time. But yeah, for sure. I think this has been great. You know, I learned a lot of things about you. I think everyone listening will enjoy the conversation. And yeah, we'll go ahead and wrap it up there.
Sure. One last thing before we go to my future patients. You can call me Tom.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.